You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 Descanso, serving San Diego and East County, and streaming live worldwide on knsj.org.
Welcome to the East County Magazine live radio show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio representing the public interest, not special interest. Broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso on KNSJ 89.1 FM, your host, Miriam Raftery.
Welcome. We have a very important show lined up today. First, Terry Wehner with Desert Protective Council will be telling us about the impacts of some major energy projects on our public lands. Jeannie Crescenzo from Amicus will join us to talk about her efforts to help homeless women veterans in East County. We debut the new People Power segment today with Janice Moore. She'll be telling you all about one East County resident's effort to help war refugees in Uganda have a better life through a fair trade business that he started. Helen Oldfield on her Sounds of History segment, also new today, will be interviewing Lisa Wood, an equestrian, explorer, and author. Plus, we'll take you on a road trip to Hakumba. In addition, Nadine Abbott will give you information about how some East County residents are getting involved, fighting to restore our Fourth Amendment freedoms. Plus, Rebecca Williamson has the buzz on how beekeeping is making a comeback in East County. Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery, and I'm here today with Terry Wehner with the Desert Protective Council, which has filed a lawsuit over environmental problems involving the Ocotillo Express wind facility. Terry also represents Solar Done Right. Terry, give us a little background about the area where this 12,500-acre project on public lands, that's our lands, folks, owned by the Bureau of Land Management, is located.
Thank you, Miriam. This project is at the foot of the Hakumba Mountains. As you're traveling east from San Diego over the mountains, you come down to this broad desert valley.
And it's a home for wildlife, and there was a lot of habitat out there, big ocotillos. Tell us a little more about what occupied that land.
Ocotillo is an area that is part of the California Desert Conservation Area. It is designated as a sensitive area. For 20 years, it was protected as a limited use area, which meant that people and vehicles could only travel on designated routes of travel. The reason for that was to protect the tremendous biodiversity of plant and animal species and the Native American cultural resources.
Wind energy has been promoted as a clean and green alternative to fossil fuels. There are several major wind projects that are proposed right here in East County, so these are important issues for our region. They're massive in scale. Each of these projects covers literally thousands of acres, with wind turbines, maybe 100 or so per project, each 500 feet tall. That's taller than the highest building in downtown San Diego. And each one has the blade span the size of a football field. But now we're learning that wind turbines can actually create their own set of environmental concerns. Terry, tell us about some of the environmental problems that wind turbines are causing.
Thank you, Miriam. The main problem we have here is that when you put in a renewable energy project remote from the cities where the energy is going to be used, you're going to end up scraping a lot of precious desert soil, and all the plants and animals that live there are going to be chased away. So they fragment the habitat, create a lot of dust and erosion. This area is a home for bighorn sheep. The species Peninsular bighorn sheep happens to be listed as a threatened species, meaning its population could go extinct if it's not managed properly. There are a lot of other impacts to the sheep in all parts of Southern California desert. An additional hit on their ability to connect with Anzabrego State Park and their genetic brethren in Mexico.
Right. The project shares a 5-mile boundary with the Anzabrego Desert State Park. Now, the turbines pose special problems for birds and bats that fly up near the turbine blades. Tell us about that.
Wind turbines are spaced fairly closely together at the base of a mountain that happens to be a migration corridor for several species. When the turbines are turning, they create a huge infrasound as well as the noise from the wind hitting the blades that can hurt bats in particular. Birds, of course, the hazard is hitting the blades themselves. Golden eagles are known to nest in areas adjacent to this project, and the Swainson's hawk, which is a bird protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, also is known to fly through here. So these are definite reasons why this turbine project is not placed in a good spot.
The Altamont Wind Project, for example, in Northern California, is rather notorious for having killed literally thousands of golden eagles who struck the blade and were hacked apart by them. Terry, tell us what some of the main issues are that are raised in your lawsuit that the Desert Protective Council has filed.
Yes, we filed a lawsuit last spring against the Federal Department of Interior, the Bureau of Land Management, and the Pattern Energy developers of the project because they did not properly vet the location of this project. They didn't conform to all of the mandates of the National Environmental Policy Act, which requires that you explore all the possible alternatives to a project before moving ahead. The federal government neglected to explore the alternative of creating energy in San Diego on rooftops and with local distributed generation rather than importing it 125 miles from a remote location.
Now, how widespread is this problem? This is not the only public land that has been targeted for renewable energy development on an industrial scale. How many other places is this happening?
The Bureau of Land Management has a desert-wide plan, which includes all of the desert states, Nevada and Arizona as well, to site industrial solar projects and some wind projects on up to 22 million acres.
22 million acres. So this is enormous. The impact's mind-boggling. How quickly does the desert restore itself once a construction project is over?
You bring up a good point. The problem with Ocotillo Wind is that it's one of many projects that are being sited, and the desert is being scraped and fragmented. The cumulative impacts on a desert that is already suffering from thousands of miles of roads, homes, off-road vehicle traffic, landfills, the desert is already hurting. It's going to be a death by a thousand cuts.
Has anyone looked at how much power the turbines are actually producing? I understand it's an area of fairly marginal winds to even qualify here in Southern California for the federal tax credits. And comparing that to how much fossil fuel is used to manufacture these huge turbines, which are mostly made overseas, ship them, build them, truck the turbine parts at remote locations, and then build the power lines and the substations for transmitting this power to urban areas.
The well-kept secret is that this so-called renewable energy project is not renewable. It requires backup fossil fuel generation to not only equalize the amount of energy that goes into the transmission lines, but to produce energy when there's no wind.
Such as the Quail Brush gas-fired power plant that's been so controversial and has been proposed for right next to Mission Trails Regional Park here in San Diego.
That would be an example of a peaker plant that was proposed to be built strictly to back up renewable energy projects in the desert.
So what is the answer if we don't want to all go back to living in caves and doing without our electricity and our computers? Is there a better alternative out there?
Well, California has a very reasonable energy plan, and they recommend that first we look to conservation of energy. We are an extravagant user of energy in Southern California. Then they recommend energy efficiency in our homes. We need to look to insulation and double pane glass, and on new homes, siting them properly to get the best of the rays of the sunlight.
Going beyond conservation, what is Solar Done Right suggesting that we do to produce additional power for meeting future needs?
Educate the public about the alternatives to remote renewable energy projects, thereby protecting our public lands. Also to work with policymakers to get them to institute incentives such as the PACE loans, Property Assessed Clean Energy Loans, so that people...
Which incidentally, Santee just approved that. The city of Santee is now having a PACE program so that residents can get upfront financing to put solar on their homes.
The local production of renewable energy is the real solution here. If we can subsidize people's efforts in that direction, we will be able to produce most of the energy we need without having to impact our public lands, which are part of our natural
heritage. So we don't
really
need to tear up places like beautiful McCain Valley and Jewel Valley that are proposed next to become wind farms out here in, or industrial wind facilities out here in East County?
The production of renewable energies in the cities, in the built environment, will protect our desert from being destroyed.
Terry, where can people get more information and get involved?
Solar Done Right has a website. We have a lot of information about the alternatives to renewable energy on public land.
Can you tell us the websites for Solar Done Right and the Desert Protective Council if people want to get more information?
Solar Done Right, that's all one word, .org. Desert Protective Council, protectdeserts, one word, .org. There's a watchdog organization that's got information on all the renewable energy projects throughout California and Nevada, Basin and Range Watch, all one word, .org.
Wonderful. And of course, you can find much more information as well in the Green Living section at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This is Janice Moore, host of People Power, profiling people and organizations making a positive difference in our community and our world.
Today I'm talking with James Pearson from Ember Arts, founded in Jamul here in East County, now with offices in Ocean Beach and El Cajon. His company sells handmade jewelry that's beautiful in every color of the rainbow. They're called Aicholi beads, and there's a fascinating story behind them. How did you first discover these beads?
Yeah, good question. So I actually moved to Uganda in 2006 to work with a nonprofit. And through some friends, I met these women who were living in a slum just outside the capital. And they were working in a rock quarry, which in Uganda means sitting on the ground and pounding rocks with kind of a makeshift hammer for hours and hours every day. And they were just barely making enough to survive, about $1 a day. But on the side, they were making this beautiful jewelry. I saw that jewelry, and the only thing they were missing was a good market to sell it in. And so that was kind of how we first got involved with them.
Oh, wow. I can't imagine what those women must have been going through as they were working so long. How difficult was life for their families?
Oh, it was real difficult. So all the women that we're working with, they had to flee their homes in the north of Uganda because there was a 20-year-long civil war. And they had been moved into these really terrible displaced persons camps, and then they fled those two and ended up the only place they could find to live was this slum outside the capital. And the work that they're doing is just tremendously difficult. And to only make $1 a day, I mean, they've got kids to feed, they've got to provide shelter. It's a really tough life.
Oh no, that sounds terrible. So you noticed the unusual jewelry that they wore. These look like ceramic beads, each in multiple colors. So how are they made?
Yeah, good question. In fact, they're not ceramic at all. They're, believe it or not, they're all made from recycled paper. So in Uganda, there's this marketplace where you can just buy kind of discarded paper from around the country. They go in there, they find these beautiful colors, and they'll cut a long strip and they'll hand roll every bead and then string it together into beautiful jewelry.
Wow, that sounds like a cool process. Then you offered to try and help them by bringing some jewelry back to the United States to sell these items. How did that work out, and where are they sold?
There were four women that we started working with, and I would go and kind of hand choose every piece of jewelry and give it to a friend who was coming back to America and say, hey, take this to my family. We just sold at, you know, farmers markets and crafts markets and things like this. And then we started approaching stores, at first kind of smaller gift shops and boutiques, but the last couple of years we've been working with some larger chains like Whole Foods.
Wow, that's great that it's been so successful. Now, this is a fair trade company that you've started. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, fair trade it's just a way of thinking about business that says that everybody along the line, from the people who are initially producing something to even the consumer at the end, should be able to benefit and feel good about what they're doing. So we've worked really hard with the women in Uganda that we work with to say, what's a fair price for what you're selling us? And what else can we do to, you know, benefit your lives?
Now, where can people learn more about helping these women in Uganda, and where can they find Aicholi beads?
So our website, emberarts.com, it's emberarts.com, is a great place to learn more about it.
Thank you for sharing your story with East County Magazine on KNSJ 89.1, the Network for Social Justice. You can also read our story and see photos of Aicholi beads at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
On Wednesday night, the Santee City Council will hold a public hearing to consider declaring eminent domain to acquire easements on dozens of properties on nine streets. The city says it needs the properties to widen Prospect Avenue and build bike lanes, sidewalks, and other improvements, as well as placing utility lines underground. But property owners have rejected an offer made by the city. Property owners and their attorneys are expected to testify at Wednesday night's meeting, which will be held at 7 p.m. in the council chambers at 10601 Magnolia Avenue in Santee. The council will also weigh in on whether to assess charges for cutting weeds at properties where owners have failed to remove the weeds. Those costs run thousands of dollars per property in some cases. On a high note, the council will make a special presentation to the Allied Climbers of San Diego in appreciation for the group Scaling Rocks to remove graffiti near Mast Park. Reporting for KNSJ, I'm Mike Hancock.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. My guest today is Lisa Wood, the noted equestrian biologist, explorer, and author. Lisa Wood, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Helen. It's a pleasure to be here.
Clearly, you are a quadruple threat lady, and those combined areas of interest have turned you into an author. At the core of what you've been all about for so many years is that famous journey on horseback up to the Oregon border. How did that come about?
Well, Helen, I happened to be in a bookstore and saw a book that looked a little bit interesting, and I purchased it and took it home and read it, and it was absolutely a fascinating book. It was written by a man who in 1911 left his home in El Monte in the Los Angeles area and rode to the Oregon border. In 1910, he actually rode to San Diego. In 1911, he rode from El Monte to Oregon. And he described his journeys. And it was just a very captivating story about the beautiful California coast. And he visited missions and tree groves and lighthouses. And he had such a good time doing it that he decided that people should do this every year. The California coast is so magnificent that every spring when the first blossoms come on the apple trees, people ought to take off and head off on horseback toward the Oregon border to enjoy the magnificent California coastline. And I read that book. In fact, I reread that book a couple of times. And at one point, I fell asleep and I dreamed about the book. I actually dreamed about the book, and I pictured Mr. Chase sitting on his horse. His horse's name was Chino, and he was headed north on the beach, and the sun was going down behind him. So I really only kind of saw a silhouette of him in my dream. And the silhouette kind of shifted a little bit, and it became me in my dream. Uh-huh. And in the morning, I woke up and decided, yes, that's me. I want to do this. And I was determined that I would.
This goes back in time for you. Were you not 2 years old when you had your first ride on horseback?
Yeah, well, so I've been told. I don't remember, but my first horseback ride, I was a toddler, and I went with a Girl Scout troop that my older sister was in the Girl Scout troop, and now, my dad took us.
You're a native Californian. That trip up through California took how long, and what kind of saddle did you ride on?
The trip to the Oregon border was about 1,500 miles, and I used a McClellan saddle. McClellan saddles were developed in the Civil War, and I specifically wanted a McClellan saddle because that's what Mr. Chase used in 1911. It was a common saddle in 1911. Not only were they used in the Civil War, but after the Civil War, they were adopted by the United States Cavalry. They were used by the Forest Service. They're a very good saddle both for riding and for packing, although if you've ever been on one, they don't have any padding on them, so you either love them or you hate them.
The saddle has a connection to a famous saddle maker here in the county?
Well, when I first purchased my McClellan saddle, it's an antique, and it needed some help before I was going to ride it 1,500 uh-huh. miles. So I took it to Gary McClintock, and Gary McClintock and Descanso did some repairs on it. And of course, being an expert on old saddles, he also was able to custom make me some McClellan saddle bags to go with my McClellan saddle.
Interesting. Lisa, what is the title of your book, which serves as a kind of sequel in modern time to Smeaton Chase's book?
My book is called Chasing the California Dream, with the word chase being taken from the original author, Joseph Smeaton Chase.
Very good. And you, in fact, have a ranch, do you not? What's its name?
I do. I have a ranch in El Monte Valley in Lakeside. My ranch is Trailblazer Ranch, appropriately named.
Is there a favorite corner of this county that you love?
I love El Monte Valley. I think El Monte Valley is the gem of San Diego County. It's one of the few places where when you ride on the trails there, you can run your horse. We've got a really good place with good substrate. You can
Great.
Ride your horses, and it's just a fabulous valley.
Lisa, I want to mention that our listeners can hear you speak further in the H. Lee House Cultural Center in Lemon Grove on June 6th at 7 p.m., Great to have you with us. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Helen.
Thanks for listening to The Sounds of History. For KNSJ, I'm Helen Ofield.
This is Rebecca Williamson running up the wildest jobs in East County. Now here's the buzz. Beekeeping is making a comeback here. Honey was once one of the top crops in East County. In the 1800s, local honey was shipped to Europe, where it was prized for its flavor and health benefits. Recently, bees have been disappearing across the United States. No one is sure why. Theories range from pesticides to genetically modified crops to global warming. But now, some determined folks are working to help bring back our bees. Today, we're here with Dragon Djuric with Bee Happy. He's going to help us all about the bee revival in our region. Dragon, what are some of the benefits that bees bring to us?
Well, the human development of the planet Earth, the way that we know it, it wouldn't be possible without the bees. And that's because the bees are the one that pollinize the flowers and the trees that we have, the fruits, all the crops that we harvest every year. So the flowers, the reason that the flowers grow, one is for the beauty, for us to enjoy it. And the second part is to attract the pollinators. So this is the main reason, the pollinization of the flowers. And the second part is what the bees produce, and that is honey, pollen, royal jelly, propolis, and wax.
That is a benefit. And how difficult is it to raise bees?
Well, it's not difficult at all if you know what you're doing, if you have the proper equipment, and if you're willing to learn.
Are local laws changing to make it easier to become a beekeeper?
Yes. In 2012, San Diego just passed a new law where you are allowed to have two beehives in the city of San Diego.
Can you tell us how to raise bees in East County?
In the city of San Diego has the easiest rules, and that's 15 feet from your neighbor. But if you live in different communities like El Cajon, La Mesa, Escondido, they all have different regulations, and the best way is to go and contact the city of one of these, Escondido or El Cajon or East County, wherever you live, and they will give you the information on the beekeeping and how far the beehives need to be from your neighbors.
What if someone has bees they don't want in their attic, for example?
This is not the place where you would want, and anybody would want, the bees in the attic. So those bees need to be removed.
And how can people get bees removed?
Well, the bee removal, it's a complex situation. My company removes the bees alive, and that's the goal here. We're educating people about the importance of the bees and why is it important to remove them alive and not kill them. So it's a complex process where the honeycomb and the total family needs to be removed and requeened. And that is because of the Africanized bees. The problem with the aggressive bees, you don't want to have aggressive bees in your neighborhood, and you should be careful dealing with the aggressive bees.
Can this job be dangerous? Are you worried about Africanized killer bees that have made their way into our region?
Well, the job is dangerous only if you present a danger to the bees. The bees are very docile creatures, and they will not attack you unless they are threatened or you go and you mess with them. So yes, you should not play with the bees, and you should not go and disturb them.
Where can people buy locally made honey?
The best place to buy honey, and you should know your source of honey, because there is a lot of honey that comes from different parts of the world where they fake the honey. They mix the honey with the syrups and all kinds of additives. So the best place to buy honey is from your local beekeeper. Farmers markets are the best places. Or beekeepers like me, we sell honey and royal jelly and bee pollen and other bee products.
Where can people get more information?
More information you can find at the San Diego Beekeeper Society. We have a large group of members. There's about more than 700 members. There's a free to join for anybody. It costs $20 a year, and you can come and listen to different topics. There's different people that come about different things. There's local beekeepers, or website. That's also another good way to learn about bees. So for more information, you can go to sandiegobeekeepersociety.com, or you can contact me directly at BeeHappy, 619-675-2636.
On July 4th, 300 San Diegans met at the fountain in Balboa Park to demand that the National Security Agency stop its surveillance programs. These were revealed by possible whistleblower Edward Snowden to the British paper The Guardian on June 7. According to Glenn Greenwald, writing for The Guardian, documents presented to him by Snowden revealed the capture of all internet data through the top-secret PRISM program. Restore the Fourth Amendment movement met on Reddit to get a movement going demanding that Congress reform the U.S. Patriot Act and to prohibit mass online and phone surveillance. They also demand the creation of a congressional committee to investigate, report, and reveal to the public the extent of this domestic spying. They also demand that officials be held responsible for this mass surveillance. On July 4th, they marched to the offices of U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein, where they intended to present a list of demands to the senator. The guards refused to receive it, so they taped it to the door. Sam, from Canvas for the Cause, read it formally to the crowd, while Aya Dupman of Restore the Fourth San Diego held it. Protesters also chalked the entrance of Symphony Hall with water, soluble chalk. Messages included things like Restore the Fourth. Before the rally, ECM talked with Dave Patterson, a resident of Ramona, of Veterans for Peace, who went into the expansion of the drone program into the United States as revealed by the New York Times on July 3rd.
Why?
Yeah, we have our 1/5 scale Reaper drone. It's the weaponized version of the Predator that is being used to kill so many innocent people around the world and creating more enemies than we're killing, by the way. But today I brought it down here to protect the Fourth because, in fact, they're using this equipment on the borders, on the north and south borders, and apparently inland as well, in some range, to surveil Americans without warrant, without any controls, and really that's the issue.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 Descanso, serving San Diego and East County, and streaming live worldwide on knsj.org. The next segment was originally recorded in June, but it's still relevant, and so we're going to play it for you now. This is Miriam Raftery with a special commentary. This time of year, we honor our veterans and our patriotism with Memorial Day and Flag Day. Today, I want to tell you a story about Michelle St. Clair, a veteran who served our country with pride. She served in the U.S. Navy with the military police. But after her service ended, Michelle fell on hard times. Like far too many of our veterans, she wound up homeless, living in a tent in a homeless camp along the San Diego River in Lakeside. Michelle worked hard to improve her life. She washed windows at homes in wealthy neighborhoods. She collected cans to recycle. On Mother's Day, Michelle spent her morning collecting cans and then crushing them at her camp. The temperature soared to 100 degrees. In that scorching heat, a brush fire began. The fire roared through the homeless camp, destroying everything. It also burned vehicles and mobile homes nearby. Michelle was found lying in the weeds by the road, where she had crawled seeking help. Both of her legs were burned so badly that they could not be saved. If she lived, she would also lose all of her fingers and her nose. Her loved one who lived with her and was also homeless had to make the heart-wrenching decision to end her life support. Michelle is remembered by her friends as a kind and cheerful spirit. As we honor our veterans, is it time to ask ourselves, what could we do to prevent veterans and other homeless people from ending up like this? What could we have done to help Michelle St. Clair? Many communities in East County have passed ordinances aimed at pushing the homeless out of parks and off sidewalks, forcing those with no place else to go into places that are dangerous. Is it time to find more humane solutions? Ironically, one local church member had been trying to start a business in El Cajon that would make products out of recycled tires. He planned to hire the homeless, the ones living at this very camp, perhaps even Michelle herself. But he has not found support. Perhaps it's time for East County leaders to join with the county and create a shelter for the homeless in East County, along with some job training and employment, so that veterans and other homeless people in East County will finally have a safe place to call home. One thing many of us take for granted is having a safe place to call home. In this economy, far too many people have fallen between the cracks, winding up homeless, including many women veterans. This can have tragic consequences for people such as Michelle St. Clair, a homeless woman veteran who died when a brush fire swept through the camp in Lakeside where she was living recently. Today, I'm here with Jeannie Crescenzo, who is an advocate for the homeless, and she started an organization called Amicus, a nonprofit that is working to help homeless people. Welcome, Jeannie.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Recently, we've had some changes in the county, at least in the city of San Diego, to help the homeless. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening over there?
Well, fortunately, we have a new mayor and people on the city council who are much more compassionate about the situation of homeless people. And so the new budget that was just passed leaves the winter shelter open year-round and also the veterans' tent. It's also got money for public restrooms 24/7. And funding for a check-in center where homeless people can leave their belongings. And money is arranged so that the Neil Good Day Center is taken care of.
And this was under the leadership of Mayor Filner, Bob Filner, who, of course, formerly chaired the Veterans Affairs Committee in Congress. But for homeless people in East County, the situation is very different. Tell us about that.
Well, there's really no place for homeless people in the county to go for emergency shelter. We don't have a county-run emergency shelter. We have the Interfaith Shelter Network that gets some funding from the county. But these are churches, and people have to rotate through them.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have been explaining to me that you're finding that a lot of women veterans are falling between the cracks and that it's easier for some type of homeless people to get help than others. Tell us what some of the problems are that you've identified.
Well, I get calls every day from women, mostly veterans. They find out about us through 211 and Courage to Call and the VA. They fall into two main categories. We have older women who don't even realize that they can get benefits from having served and who are in situations in their life now where they're not working, they can't afford housing, maybe they have some health problems, their families have moved away. And then the other category, which is growing, it's just unconscionable how fast it's growing, is women veterans who are recent veterans. They're coming from Iraq and Afghanistan.
And this is truly a new phenomenon, isn't it, to have so many young women who are homeless, especially veterans?
Yeah. Well, typically, it took Vietnam veterans about 10 years to go from being discharged to becoming homeless. We're seeing it almost immediate now in both male and female veterans. But female veterans have a particular problem because many of them are being discharged with other than honorable discharge status rather than honorable.
And why is that happening?
Because they've been sexually assaulted. And if they report it, this is the way the military gets rid of them, makes the problem go away. And it sends a message to these women, don't report it, don't make a big stink.
So they've been victimized once,
yes,
and then they come here, and
they're
this makes everything harder.
They're victimized repeatedly by the system.
Now, there's a stereotype out there that many of the homeless have issues such as substance abuse. To what degree are you seeing that in these women that you were trying to help, Jeannie?
The women that we're helping do not have substance abuse problems. There are many services out there for people who have substance abuse problems. So we're almost punishing people, the moms who take the responsibility for taking care of their kids, can't get a job, can't afford the rental prices, which are out of this world, and they have no place to go.
So your efforts are to help these women who've done nothing wrong other than just
trying to make it.
Right. Tell us about amicus and these homeless group homes that you have, where they are, how people can get help, what services you offer them.
Right now, we just have one home. We started out with real big ideas of, you know, there's 3,000 people in downtown who need housing and so many veterans. And we had to keep bringing our concept down to the lowest denominator, and that's group housing. With group housing, our costs for per person per night are extremely low, and we've proven that it works. So you take a single family home in a middle, low middle income house neighborhood, and we can put up to 6 unrelated adults in that house without going for permits and zoning and all that.
And beyond the roof over their heads, do you offer them additional types of help?
There's so many services out there that are already connected to provide those services. So what we can do is bring those services into Amicus House or refer our women to those services.
So you help them find services they might not know about.
Yes.
That are out there for them. Now, I understand you're looking to start 4 more group homes for the homeless people, including one here in East County.
That's our plan. By December of 2014, we hope to have 5 houses in operation, and one in North County, one in East County, one in Southeast San Diego, and probably another one in downtown.
What do you need to make that happen?
Oh, lots of money. We are not going for
your
VA
nonprofit
funding.
We should mention, you can accept donations.
And we do ask our women to pay rent, but it's a very low, affordable rent. We need that to sustain.
Do you have the properties already?
We're looking for rentals or to purchase property that it's going to cost us very, very little and no down payment. So if we can get an REO deeply discounted, our monthly payment would be no more than a rental payment. So we're looking for a 4-bedroom, 2 or 2.5 bathroom in middle-income neighborhoods, low middle-income neighborhoods.
What are some of the success stories you have? How has this helped the women who have been into the home that you already have?
Oh, it's night and day. We have one gal there who was living in camped in for a year in Balboa Park. This
wow.
is a veteran. This is someone who served our country. Someone who, because of being raped in the military, does not have a honorable discharge. So we've brought her into the house. She's doing fabulous. We're working with her to get her status upgraded so that she can get the benefits she needs. And hopefully she'll go on and be able to get a job and be on her own.
Well, very good. And you also help people find job training or education if that's
what
they need?
Well, we work very closely with a lot of other organizations, including Able Disabled Advocacy, that works with our veterans.
Where can people get more information if they want to help or they want to get involved?
They can go to our website, amicus.org, and that's AMIKAS.org, or they can give me a call, 619-822-2782.
Very good, Jeannie. Thanks so much for joining us on this celebration of independent media on Independence Day here in San Diego.
Thank you.
This is Lynn Moneyfires bringing you the Tribal Beat, covering the news for and about our region's Native American communities. Today's guest on Tribal Beat is Eric Runningpath. Eric is a member of the Navajo Nation and a professional Native American dancer who produces and performs traditional Native dances. But I learned that he's much more than that. He's traveled throughout the world as a cultural spokesman and peace ambassador, and he's going to share that experience with us today. Good morning, Eric. Thank you for joining us.
Yate. Hello. How are you?
Yate. I've seen one of your local library performances, and I was just spellbound by the elegance and beauty of the dance. How long have you been dancing, and how did you get into it?
I've been dancing now for almost 38, 39 years, and started dancing when I was about 9 years old. And my family, my dad being Navajo, going to different events growing up when we were little, to many powwow gatherings and a lot up at Barona, watching the dancers and learning the steps, listening to the drum, because a lot of it's all through hearing the tempo of the beat and watching the dancers and their mm-hmm. step and being able to pick it up and just started getting out there.
Wonderful.
Speaking of the dances, can you share the meaning of a couple of those?
I do grass dancing, what we call northern grass dancing. And northern grass dancing, the regalia is the proper name of our Indian clothing that we wear, represents the grass that grows upon the hills of Mother Earth. And in North South Dakota, Wyoming, a lot of tall grass. And dancers would go out and stump the tall grass and take and cut pieces of the grass, put it in their clothing, and that's what this yarn represents. They would say the prayer where the village was going to be or the gathering was going to take place. Mm-hmm. We do the eagle dance, the Hopi. Many tribes, the Cherokees, do the eagle dance, and I do the Hopi-style eagle dance. Mm-hmm. The dancing through the rings of circles to be able to keep the circle of life ongoing. Uh-huh. And so the warrior dance, a variety to honor our warriors and our veterans as well.
With all that you've done and all the places that you've traveled to, what are you the most proud of accomplishing?
Gosh, I've done so many different cultural events, different events all over. I've done the 1984 Olympics. I was known as the Olympic Indian. Oh. I was one of 30 Native Americans and the only two from San Diego to be able to participate, and the one being on TV.
Wow.
Traveling to other countries, dancing in Moscow in 1990. Mm-hmm. For a youth conference in Moscow, Tajikistan, Denmark, Belgium, France, all over, sharing, and in Israel, in Jerusalem.
Tell me about Jerusalem.
Jerusalem was a very, very incredible opportunity. I was asked to participate in a peace conference event in Jerusalem, and to dance, to share my culture. And I got to go over and I danced for 2,000 Palestinian and Israeli people and got to go to both sides there and meet also a lot of youth, young kids, and share my talents, my culture, our traditions of dances. And they just love being a native, just the over warmth of being there.
That's wonderful, powerful to do 3,000 people in front of the temple. That must have been an amazing thing. Yes. Understand you worked with Duncan Hunter.
Yes, I worked with Duncan Hunter Sr. for many, many years. And in 1990, with all the traveling and giving back to the community, all the different things that I've done, he appointed me as ambassador through Congress to the United States.
A well-earned designation. Thank you. I mentioned earlier that I saw you at one of the library performances. Why the libraries?
The library is to be able to share. I do so many schools, preschools, libraries in our community, and it's always great to be able to give back and to be able to share traditions, the dances, the songs that are handed down from generations and generations, and to have those kids be proud of their culture, their background, natives, the kids that are from the different reservations in our area here, and also kids that are non-natives, if they're African-American, Hispanic, German, Irish, Chaldean, whatever it might be, to be able to keep their traditions, their language, their ongoing culture alive.
That's a definition of giving back to the community. I know I appreciate that. And where can people contact you?
They can contact me at runpath09@yahoo.com on my email.
Okay, that's runpath09@yahoo.com. Thank you, Eric, for sharing your story with us today. I'm hoping you might come back and share some of your stories over at Moscow and Jerusalem. Continued success on your path. Thank you, listeners, for turning into the Tribal Beat. If you have a story you would like to hear more about or a person of interest in the community, contact us at editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
Welcome to Vines and Wines with your host, Greg Manis of the Manis Vineyards Estate.
Hello, San Diego. Welcome to Vines and Wines. It's a radio show that introduces you to many of the rising new superstars and energized people in the local wine industry that will forever change the landscape of San Diego as it emerges into a brand new EVA wine growing district. There's a lot going on, so let's get moving. Today is a very special day for me. I'm very excited to introduce our first guests on the show, a couple who are very good friends of mine, Mike and Linda McWilliams, owners of San Pasquale Winery, whose cool little tasting room is located right here in the East County. How long have you now owned the San Pasquale Winery? What's the story?
Well, a few years ago, Linda and I were looking for a wine bar to purchase or rent or start up. That's something we could do in our retirement days. And so we were doing our due diligence on the internet and looking for properties or businesses available. And one day we came across a winery for sale, an urban winery for sale. We kind of joked about it for a little while, and they had just changed the law in California so you could actually serve wine by the glass at a winery.
Very nice.
We kind of joked, well, maybe we'll just buy the winery and start our wine bar and cut out the middleman. We'll make all our own wine. So talked about it, just joked for a couple of weeks, and then Linda said, well, why don't we just go take a look at it? So we did, and kind of the rest is history.
Yeah. Wow.
We totally fell in love with it. It was, like, so cool to have everything you need to make wine in a 1,400-square-foot warehouse space.
What kind of wines are you currently producing? You've been at this a few years now. You're pioneers. You're one of the first people in the East County to get this thing going. What's your specialty? What's the deal?
Well, our local specialty is our passion fruit wines, and passion fruit from San Diego County. I think that's what people really know us by because it's so unusual. But we also get local grapes from all over San Diego County, from Rancho Santa Fe out to Jamul to El Cajon to all over. And we're getting Albarino, Sangiovese, Petit Syrah, Syrah, Petit Verdot, just some beautiful grapes that we're able to get, and you know, we continue to look for more.
So maybe a dozen different wines you're producing now?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, such a short period of time. Mm-hmm, fantastic. Mm-hmm. Could you give us a little bit of information about your visionary plans to take your current fermentation facility, which I think is in Pacific Beach, and create the very first winemaking facility and fermentation building here, right here in La Mesa? How's that going?
It's going well. Maybe not quite as quick as we would like, but it is going. We decided after opening the tasting room here in La Mesa and being fairly successful with that, that we'd really like to have the production facility a little closer to home too. And we also needed much more space than we've got. We're tripling the size in the new facility, and we hope to be up and running by early June.
How difficult was it to get that legislation passed to get this thing rolling here in La Mesa?
Well, there were some regulatory roadblocks to start. When I first approached the city planning department with the idea over a year ago, nobody thought there should be a problem with it. We were looking at the industrial area here in La Mesa, and they pulled out the zoning, and we started checking it just to make sure. Lo and behold, though, there were a couple clauses in there that proved to be problematic. One said no production of alcohol, and the other one said no fermentation of fruit products. And both of those seem to nix the idea.
They seem to go hand in hand with winemaking. So you had some help from the mayor. That was Mayor
Madrid.
Mayor Madrid helped with this process.
Yes, he did, and the entire city council. He brought it to city council's attention that there was this provision in the zoning. And with the movement towards microbreweries and micro wineries being a successful part of a lot of the community's commercial business these days, the city council decided to direct the planning department to look into what it would take to open up that zoning to allow small breweries and wineries. So with help from the mayor, the city council, a lot of hard work by the planning department in La Mesa, they researched it, wrote a report recommending that the zoning be changed, and finally, I think that went into effect in December. So that's when we started our lease negotiations in earnest.
So coming soon, we'll have the very first one. Listen, but either one of you could help me with this one. Where do you see the San Diego wine industry growing into the next 10 or 20 years? I think our listeners want to know.
Well, I think right now they need to know that San Diego County is the fastest growing wine area in the state. So that's pretty amazing news. We have over 71 bonded wineries in San Diego County. That's not Temecula, which is Riverside County, just in San Diego County. And through the San Diego County Vintners Association, we are working on activities and events to help educate the people of San Diego County and outside San Diego County to increase San Diego as a destination, besides the beaches and the zoo and all the other things we have, that we are a winery destination, a good wine destination, and looking at agrotourism as something to really benefit us.
Agrotourism.
It is indeed.
Well, Linda, as the vice president of the San Diego Vintners Association, do you think there needs to be more vineyards planted on a large scale to meet the demands of new winemakers coming to San Diego versus them buying it from wherever? I mean, there's grapes that need to be grown here, right?
Absolutely. And because San Diego is such the perfect place for grape growing. We have so many different microclimates here. We can grow just about anything within our borders here. Just we have elevation, we have valleys, we've got it all. And you know, one of the things that keeps us from saying we have a signature variety for San Diego, but we are going to have varieties, the full range that is going to benefit everyone, and we really need put some vines in the ground.
Well, there you have it, another small taste of wine to savor and share with your friends. Thanks for tuning in today. Until next time, I'll see you again on the radio. Mike, Linda, thank you. Cheers, guys.
Cheers, guys.
Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Vines and Wines with Greg Manis, proprietor of the Manis Vineyards Estate. Visit the website at manisvineyards.com.
An Amera Media production.
We're on the road in East County, visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
This is Miriam Raftery. This week, we're on the road in Hakumba Hot Springs, a town that is bubbling with activity. The town recently changed its name to take back its historic roots. The name Hakumba means healing waters and traces its roots back to the Kumeyaay Native American people who used to spend their winters by these natural hot springs. By the 1920s, Hakumba had become a mecca for Hollywood celebrities in the silent movie era. But then a fire burned down the historic hotel and bathhouse, and construction of Interstate 8 moved traffic away from old Highway 80 through the heart of this community. Hakumba almost became a ghost town, but now it is springing back to life, thanks to the vision of the people here with us today. Dave Landman is a successful businessman who was actually asked by the townspeople to buy a rundown spa and resort and turn it once again into a destination to draw people to Hakumba Hot Springs. So he bought the promissory note for the Hakumba Hot Springs Resort, and he made a surprising discovery. Dave, tell us what else was in that note.
Well, it turns out that the promissory note was secured by 29 properties throughout the town. It included most of the downtown area, some residential sites, and a lot of vacant land.
So what was your reaction when you learned that you were the proud new owner of an entire town?
Well, it went from one project to 29 projects, so it was a little bit overwhelming at the time.
Now, the people of the town were confident that Dave could make this a success because he already owns another wildly successful business in Hakumba. Tell us about that, Dave.
Yeah, about 15 years ago, my wife and I bought a rundown RV park on the north side of Interstate 8, and we actually turned it into the eighth largest clothing optional resort in the United States, the Anza Springs Resort.
So what is so attractive about Hakumba to bring so many people there?
It's a number of things. Number one, it's just an hour away from San Diego. So, you know, we call that the daycation destination place where people can come out for the weekend or just for the day use and enjoy the facilities. There's also the climate is beautiful because we're above the clouds, and in the summertime especially, we're so much cooler than the valley. So we get a lot of people up there from the El Centro, Yuma, Palm Springs area.
Now, Dave has been hard at work remodeling the Hakumba Hot Springs Resort, adding a new restaurant and a Southwest decor. But there won't be any skinny dipping since the spa will not be clothing optional. You can find out more about their big opening season plans at the www.hakumbaresort.com. Now, Dave, what else are you planning in the area?
Nothing is finalized yet, but we've had a number of calls from people interested in renting some of the retail spaces. We've had some artists contact us because they know our desire to turn it into an art-type community. We're working on a number of things. You know, some of the things in the back of my head are maybe a winery. We've talked about a number of other things, but that one kind of comes to the head all the time.
Thank you very much, Dave. Danielle Cook is a driving force behind the Hakumba Boulevard Revitalization Alliance. In fact, she and her husband, Howard, helped recruit Dave to buy the Hot Springs Resort. Danielle, tell us about your vision for Hakumba Hot Springs.
My vision of Hakumba Hot Springs is similar to that of the Landmans. I envision the community as being another backcountry version, if you will, of Taos, New Mexico, a community where artists gather, where entrepreneurs want to come in and build businesses, where people want to come and chill out at the Hot Springs Spa and enjoy our special air, light, and ambiance.
You've started some websites where people can find out more about the hidden treasures in Hakumba Hot Springs and the surrounding areas.
Yes, we started a website about a year ago, www.gosandiegobackcountry.org, to give tourists an idea of some of the free things that they could do in the backcountry, in Boulevard and Tacumba, and also places where they could stay, places where they could eat. We even have a section that tells people of different hikes they can go on and gives them an idea of a road trip that they can take with their family.
And you also have another website devoted just to Hakumba, and that site is hakumba.org.
Yes.
Now, there is also a lake, Lake Hakumba, which had gone virtually dry, and now I understand it's being restored.
Hakumba Lake now is for a virtual birder's paradise. The lake is filling up naturally. We have nesting tricolors, which are a bird of special interest, according to the Audubon. We have birders there every weekend, and this has brought in business for Hakumba Lounge and will bring in business for the spa. In addition, some of the residents of Hakumba have taken it upon themselves to clear brush and have built trails, so you can now walk almost entirely around the lake.
Wow, that's great. Now, the Hakumba Lounge is a new Wi-Fi cafe and coffee house that opened up recently. Plus, as you mentioned, the Hakumba Hikers and Walkers is another new group that's formed, and they're leading people on treks all over through the scenic mountains, deserts, and historic sites in this region. Hakumba also has an arts council, and recently they revived another town tradition, the Hakumba Blues Festival.
Enigmatic love. A love like no other. Ooh-hoo-hoo. In the summer sun, I strolled the shore. The sand warmed my feet. The waves soothed my heart within a glowing light.
I'm here today with Joe Marshall, a talented blues musician who is the powerhouse behind the festival. Joe, tell me how long you've been playing the blues.
Well, I've been playing the blues for about 45 years, and I got interested in the blues. Some friends of mine started turning me on to it. At the time, I was interested in most rock and roll, I guess about anybody my age would have been. And I found that the blues suited more of my music, because I primarily play the harmonica. I love the blues because it's for everybody. It's from the working man to the white collar.
This is the second annual Hakumba Blues Festival. What makes this such a special event for the local musicians?
It's a great event for the local musicians. They get to network. They get to meet a lot of other musicians from all over. We had musicians from San Diego. We had musicians from Imperial Valley. We had musicians from the Midwest. We had musicians from Northern California. And so it made it very special. Primarily because of that, and secondly because it gave all these people a chance to reunite.
So it's one big jam session out there.
One big family, one big jam session, yes.
We're going to end today by playing a little riff here from Mama Christie, who is one of the talented musicians that you could hear out at the Hakumba Blues Festival. And you can find her music at www.mamachristie.com. This song is called Drip. And it was written after the 9/11 attacks, and it's all about the healing power of love. And here in the town of Healing Waters, Hakumba Hot Springs, it seems especially fitting. You can find out more about Hakumba Hot Springs at www.eastcountymagazine.org, and be sure to tune in for future editions of On the Road in East County. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show. You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 Descanso, serving San Diego and East County, and streaming live worldwide on knsj.org.